What were the social and economic impacts of the 1973 coup in Chile? In what ways did it serve as a model for U.S.-backed interventions across Latin America and around the world? Who were the critical players in the coup? Where does the coup fit in with the pattern of neoliberal economic reform that has since swept the world? And how did the 1998 arrest of former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet impact on the global human rights struggle and the efforts toward accountability for state criminality? In the next hour, we'll speak with two individuals with expertise to address these questions. Global researchers Michel Chosudovsky, who was in Chile at the time of the coup, and Peter Kornbluh, author of The Pinochet File, a declassified dossier on atrocity and accountability. On today's show, the Chilean coup, remembering the other September 11th. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of September 12th, 2013. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. Our show is also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. John Kerry's farce and Barack Obama's pirouettes are temporary. Russia's peace deal over chemical weapons will, in time, be treated with the contempt that all militarists reserve for diplomacy. With Al-Qaeda now among its allies and U.S.-armed coup masters secure in Cairo, the U.S. intends to crush the last independent states in the Middle East, Syria first, then Iran. Quote, "This operation in Syria," said the former French Foreign Minister Roland Dumas in June, "goes way back. It was prepared, preconceived, and planned," unquote. That's from Hiroshima to Syria, The Enemy Whose Name We Dare Not Speak, by John Pilger, posted September 10th, originally published at johnpilger.org. For Russia and China, for the SCO, as well as for the BRICS and NAM countries, Syria became a red line to put a stop to U.S., NATO, OECD global military unilateralism aimed at opening NATO to countries as far-flung as South Korea, Australia, and Colombia. And Syria became the test case for returning global governance to the rule of international law and the UN Charter. Judging from the Congress debates, the U.S. and NATO have been framing their response to this major challenge. That response is now clear. The U.S., the U.K., and France will act on their own and outside the U.N. if necessary to further their interests and prolong their hegemony, while couching such unilateralism as selective humanitarian imperative to protect civilians. That's from the article, "Funny Things Keep Happening on the Way to the War on Syria. The Whole World is on a Dangerously Slippery Slope," by Juned Kam, posted September 10th. The declassified documents could not have spelled it out any clearer. The military coup that overthrew Mossadegh and his National Front cabinet was carried out under CIA direction as an act of U.S. foreign policy conceived and approved at the highest levels of government. In the 21st century, Washington is attempting to repeat its 1953 feat of overthrowing the Iranian government, this time using the faux Green Revolution, financed by Washington. When that fails, Washington will rely on military action. If 60 years is the time that must pass before Washington's crimes can be acknowledged, the U.S. government will admit the truth about September 11, 2001, on September 11, 2061. In 2013, on this 12th anniversary of 9/11, we only have 48 years to go before Washington admits the truth. And that is from the article commemorating September 11, 2001, Too Many Years of Lies from Mossadegh to 9/11 by Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, posted September 11th, originally published at paulcraigroberts.org. The media is drumbeating for the war just as before Iraq, and they don't want to hear that the evidence is very, very flimsy. They don't want to hear that people within the CIA, senior people, with great access to this information, assures us, the veterans, that there's no conclusive evidence that Assad ordered those chemical incidents on August 21st. They want to process beyond that and just deal with what we must do. Now, you don't assume those things. You need proof of them. That is from the article, CIA Fabricated Evidence to Lure U.S. into War with Syria. That's Ray McGovern, transcribed from an RT interview posted September 10th. Every crisis, from 9/11 itself, and including all the interventions and regime changes, has been manufactured. What we're seeing is a classic case of create crisis, offer solution. In appearance, we see great power leaders restoring the rule of law and the primacy of legislative bodies. The natural next step in this sea change scenario would be for the same thing to be orchestrated on a global scale, for the great powers to recognize the primacy of the UN, giving us the rule of law globally. An apparent close escape with great power confrontation has created a PR climate conducive to bringing in the long-planned NWO global government. That is from the article Obama's Back Down and the New World Order Project by Richard K. Moore, posted September 11th. There is proof the footage of the alleged chemical attack in Syria was fabricated. Mother Agnes Mariam el-Salib, Mother Superior of St. James Monastery in Qara, Syria, told RT. Mother Agnes, a Catholic nun who has been living in Syria for 20 years and has been reporting actively on what has been going on in the war-ravaged country, says she carefully studied the video featuring alleged victims of the chemical weapons attack in the Syrian village of Ghouta in August and now questions its authenticity. In her interview with RT, Mother Agnes doubts so much footage could have been taken in so little time and asks where parents of the supposed dead children are. She promises to send her report to the UN. The nun is indignant with the world media for apparently turning a blind eye to the Latakia massacre by rebel extremists, which left 500 civilians, including women and children, dead. That is from Mother Agnes Mariam. Footage of chemical attack in Syria is fraud, posted September 9th. On the 12th anniversary of 9/11, a new national survey by the polling firm YouGov reveals that 1 in 2 Americans have doubts about the government's account of 9/11, and after viewing video footage of World Trade Center Building 7's collapse, 46% suspect that it was caused by a controlled demolition. The poll was sponsored by Rethink 911, a global public awareness campaign launched on September 1st. The campaign includes a 54-foot billboard in Times Square and a variety of transit and outdoor advertising in 11 other cities, all posing the question, did you know a third tower fell on 9/11? The Rethink 911 campaign calls for a new investigation into Building 7's collapse, as well as the destruction of the Twin Towers. The YouGov poll and the ad campaign were financed with more than $225,000 in donations from thousands of supporters. That is from New Poll Finds Most Americans Open to 9/11 Truth from Rethink 911, posted September 9th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. The September 11th, 1973 coup in Chile was notable not only for its being a U.S.-sponsored military overthrow of a democratic government, but also for its pivotal role in the development of global economics. Michel Chossudovsky is Emeritus Professor of Economics at the University of Ottawa and founder of the Center for Research on Globalization. He was in Chile at the time of the coup as a visiting professor of economics at the Catholic University of Chile. He joins us by phone from his home near Montreal to share his unique recollections and insights into that historic event. So thank you very much for joining us, Michel Chosedovsky.
It's a great pleasure.
Do you want to talk about your recollection of when you went down in Chile and just give us some sense of what things looked like on the ground in the moments leading up to the coup? First of all, like what the conditions of the people were like and what kind of an environment we were talking about.
Well, I, first of all, I should mention I was a young, essentially pretty much neoliberal, neoclassical economist at the time. I was recruited by the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, which is a well-established hotbed of training for the U.S. State Department and Washington think tanks and so on, under a program which was called Latin American Teaching Fellowship. And I joined the Catholic University of Chile, which was a hotbed of the Chicago School at that time. I took leave from the University of Ottawa. And I found myself among a group of people which were, broadly speaking, against the Unidad Popular Coalition of Salvador Allende. They were neoliberal economists, many of them trained in Chicago. There were a few progressive people within that department. And it was abundantly clear that something was being prepared from, in the months preceding September 11. And in fact, what happened on September 11 and in the immediate aftermath of the coup was a breakup of all the social safety nets which the Allende government had implemented. Subsidies of basic food staples, health care, price controls, under extremely difficult conditions. In other words, there's a food distribution program. But certain commodities could only be purchased on the black market. There was a process of destabilization. And ultimately, economic destabilization was really instrumental in creating also a movement among certain opposition sectors that a coup was necessary and that they supported a coup. And those were the sort of center-right, middle-class people who had also been affected by this process of destabilization.
Could you possibly give us an understanding? Because I think a lot of like progressive-minded people are knowledgeable about the coup itself, but maybe don't have that much of an understanding of the impacts, like in concrete terms,
Well, when after the coup, I started analyzing the economic and social consequences of the reforms which were implemented already in early October. The coup was on September 11. Two or three weeks later, what happened was that the military junta ordered a hike in the price of bread from 11 to 40 escudos, an overnight increase of almost 300%. And this was accompanied by the price of increases in the price of other basic staples, such as milk. Fuel prices skyrocketed. And in the meantime, what they did was to freeze nominal wages so that wages didn't go up they didn't go up in nominal terms and they collapsed in real terms. And from one day to the next, large sectors of the population, including the middle class, were precipitated into abysmal poverty. And I started analyzing these price data, income distribution, as well as the impacts on food consumption and on nutrition. I worked with a medical doctor who was specialized in nutrition, and I came up with devastating conclusions that this shock treatment, the economic policy of the junta, was in fact conducive to pushing 85% of the population below the poverty line, based on criteria of calorie and protein intake. Because during the Allende period, despite the instability in the distribution system, bread was accessible at a fixed price, and it was a basic staple. And immediately following the coup, well, they devalued the currency, and then prices simply went fly high. So that was the background, and for me, this realization that that economic reform, specifically macroeconomics, could be used as an instrument of social repression was something very important as an economist. The price of bread went up, 300%, almost four times in early October. And if we look at the year following the coup, it went up 36 times, 3,700% of inflation in the price of bread, and so that all this manipulation of prices, which economists tend to dismiss because they say it's a free market and prices are determined by the market, they're not. They are manipulated, and in this particular case, they were set by the junta, and the junta was integrated by many of my colleagues actually were at the Catholic University, became cabinet ministers overnight. Okay, I couldn't stay in that hotbed of neoliberalism very long. I decided to leave the country in December of 73, and I went to the Catholic University of Peru, with which I had previous contacts, and I finished my leave from the University of Ottawa at the Catholic University of Peru, and I was also involved in writing up a lot of what I had discovered in terms of these devastating reforms, this was, in a sense, if we look at the situation in Chile in 73 and recall those events, what I witnessed was, in effect, the dress rehearsal of the IMF reforms of the late 70s, early 80s, which have been imposed on more than 100 countries. It's a menu of freezing wages, free prices of basic food staples, removal of price controls, and ultimately a process of programmed impoverishment through the use of macroeconomic reform.
So you talk about macroeconomic reforms essentially as a tool of repression, and you're saying that Chile is really the first instance of this being used.
Well, it was the first instance of a consistent process of economic repression. But it did not end in Chile, and there were other countries in the 70s that experienced that. Argentina in 76 was based in effect, it was based on the Chilean experience. It was not as dramatic in terms of actual hikes in food prices, but nonetheless, when the coup was implemented in March of 1976, there was a significant collapse of real wages. It was something of the order of 35% to 40%, but in Chile, the collapse was of the order of 60% immediately following the coup.
Was there anything special about Latin America and Chile in particular that it would become the staging point for this, I guess, birth of neoliberal globalization?
Well, I don't think it was necessarily Latin America which set the stage of neoliberalism, although if we look at the debt crisis, it started in Mexico, but in fact it was applied all over the world. Historically, these first programs of macroeconomic programs were applied in Chile, Argentina, also in Uruguay, in Brazil, in Peru, at different periods. Now, some of the more devastating IMF reforms, or perhaps the most devastating macroeconomic reforms, were applied in Peru in 1991. Of course, we're talking about a later period. But if I have to compare to Chile, it's important that I make that comparison, because I lived through also the period in Peru in the early 90s when the price of fuel went up 30 times in one day. Okay, the price of fuel went up 30 times, and the price of all basic food commodities literally went through the roof. We weren't talking about a fourfold increase. We're talking about 16-fold increase, and I'd have to check the numbers on that, but fuel prices went up 30 times overnight. That is unprecedented, and the irony is that mainstream economists didn't even express any concern regarding these price movements. One can well imagine that if the price of fuel, let's say at the pump, in the suburbs of Toronto, goes up 36 times overnight, it paralyzes an entire economy. And that's exactly what happened in Peru. People couldn't go back to their hometowns. They were stranded in the capital city. They had to go back 100 kilometers. They couldn't take the bus anymore because bus fares immediately had gone up. Transportation was undermined, internal trade, and the standard of living literally collapsed. In Peru, I'd estimated collapse in living standards of the order of, I was looking at real wages, but the real wages collapsed by more than 80%. And those types of reforms were never the object of any kind of concern by mainstream economists. Now, when I conducted the study on Peru in 1990, I went down to Peru to analyze the economic reforms, and this was actually a study which at the time was, it was a North-South Institute study out of Ottawa, which was funded by the Canadian International Development Agency. And when I submitted my first report, which was factual, they said, no, we refuse this report because the Canadian consensus at the time was that this increase in fuel prices of 30 times was something which was required, that they had to move these prices up to world market levels and so on and so forth. And they were not in any way concerned about the social impacts on vast sectors of the population. And as a result, that particular study that I did in Peru, which was funded by the Canadian government through the Don Institute, it was never published. And then I subsequently I published it in a chapter of my book, Globalization. And I also brought out a book in Peru, which was called, it was a book written in Spanish, short book. It's called The IMF Under the Brunt of the, the Peru Under the Brunt of the International Monetary Fund. And that book was published, and it was removed from bookstores across the capital city, and apparently nobody saw the book. So the whole process of revealing the impacts of these price hikes and freeze of wages was ultimately the object of censorship, both in terms of the publication in Canada, but also the fact that my book in Spanish was confiscated.
So it was vital to keep a lid on those economic impacts.
Well, I think what people have to understand, going back to September 11, 1973, is that you can't simply analyze a military coup or even a war, for that matter, and not look into the macroeconomic dimensions. The fact that immediately in the wake of a regime change, whether that regime change is taking place in Chile or Argentina or in Egypt, the macroeconomic reforms are ultimately what is decisive, because they will determine the standard of living of the population. And if you implement macroeconomic reforms which deregulate the price of basic food staples and freeze the wages, well, then you're going to have a situation of impoverishment. You're going to have a mass protest movement. And incidentally, talking about Egypt, in 1991, at the height of the Gulf War, those reforms, macroeconomics reforms, were implemented, and one of the conditions was the lifting of price controls on basic food staples. And that was the beginning of the process of destabilization and impoverishment of Egypt at the time. And I should also mention that one of the conditions imposed on Egypt was the deregulation of the grain market and the liberalization of food imports, which was conducive to the destruction of the world's most important breadbasket, which is the Nile Valley, and which has been producing food staples for, you know, several thousand years, if we go back to the antiquity. And so those reforms are absolutely fundamental. They are, in a sense, they accompany the process of military intervention, whether it's in the form of a theater war like in Iraq or Afghanistan, or whether it's in the form of a military coup like in Chile or in Argentina in the 1970s.
Well, Michel Chossudovsky, I know that we could probably go at length on this topic. It's certainly a very important one, but I think we'll probably have to close it there. But I want to thank you very much for sharing those perspectives on this rather important anniversary. So thanks for joining us.
Delighted to be on the program.
Professor Michel Chossudovsky is the founder and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, and he recently authored an article on the Global Research website. It's called Chile, September 11th, 1973, The Ingredients of a Military Coup.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast Thursdays at 10 a.m. on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. Canada and on partner radio stations across the country. We are podcast on the website globalresearch.ca and are aired on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We will continue our discussion of the 1973 coup d'etat in Chile with author Peter Kornbluh in moments, but first, here is some music from the popular Chilean folk group Inti Illimani, whose song Venceremos became the anthem of Salvador Allende's popular unity government. Here is their song, Alturas. Peter Kornbluh is the director of the Chile Documentation Project at the U.S. National Security Archive. He authored the 2003 book, The Pinochet File, a declassified dossier on atrocity and accountability, which has recently been updated in a new edition for the 40th anniversary of the Chilean coup. Kornbluh was able to get more than 20,000 documents pertaining to the role of the U.S. in the coup declassified. He joined us by phone on the anniversary of the September 11th coup. Peter Kornbluh, I wonder if maybe you could just explain quickly what were the circumstances that allowed this declassification to take place, and how is it related to the arrest in 1998 of Augusto Pinochet by Scotland Yard?
Oh, it's completely related to the arrest of Augusto Pinochet on October 16th, 1998. His arrest, you know, was a transformational moment, Michael. It was a sea change for Chile. It stunned the world, and it galvanized and mobilized the international human rights movement. And one of the almost immediate impacts was in the United States, where prominent victims such as Joyce Horman, whose husband Charles had been killed in the National Stadium, and the family of Ronnie Carvin Moffat, who had been killed by a car bomb planted by Pinochet agents in Washington, D.C., were able to push the Clinton administration to do a special declassification project because of Pinochet's arrest. I was involved also in lobbying for that, and our position to the Clinton administration was, why should you protect this international human rights criminal by keeping secret key U.S. documents that reported on his repression and could provide evidence for the Spanish, who will want to prosecute him for crimes against humanity, to actually bring him to justice. And eventually the Clinton administration did decide, to its credit, to release the documents publicly, not to release them to give them to Spain, because they didn't want to set a precedent for countries coming to the United States all the time for secret documents to prosecute people, but literally just to declassify a huge body of information, 24,000 documents never seen before, including 2,000, by the way, operational CIA cables, and make those available to Chileans, put them on the State Department's website for people to use for years to come.
Mm. Yeah, but the downside, of course, being that you're also revealing elements of the complicity of the U.S., their own clandestine operations, but that was somehow overcome.
Well, that was a long and complicated story, and you should know that initially the special Clinton declassification project was supposed to just focus on the 17 years of the Pinochet dictatorship, and the whole tasker was written saying that agencies should look for documents that dealt with human rights violations, dealt with state-sponsored terrorism, and dealt with political violence in Chile. Then somebody in the State Department, I actually know his name, but I won't mention it, one State Department official stepped in and said, gosh, if we just release documents on the Pinochet era, we're going to look like we're dumping on Pinochet. We really should release documents on the Allende era also, so that people can see that he was a bad guy and he was a communist and et cetera. Of course, Allende did not close down the Chilean Congress. Allende did not close down all of the Chilean media. Allende did not create torture centers and a murderous secret police force. So, but this guy won the debate, and so the parameters of the declassification were changed to 1970 to 1990 instead of 1973 to 1990. And because the tasker was to look for documents on political violence, my office forcefully argued that the CIA was now obliged to declassify all of its operational records on fomenting a coup in Chile. What more defines political violence in an effort to foment a coup in another country?
Well, when we we're looking back to the origins of this, we're looking at the Nixon administration's and the concerns they were raising about Salvador Allende. Now, what based on what you've uncovered, what new insights have you gotten into what their the extent of their concerns about Allende and the direction that he would be taking the country?
Everybody should understand that Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger's position on Salvador Allende, who was the first democratically elected socialist leader in the world. There had not been an open election of a Marxist leader anywhere before he was elected in 1970 in Chile. And the position of Nixon and Kissinger was to have a preemptive strike. They wanted to move against him even before he actually was inaugurated as president. So whatever policies he had, they didn't really know. They weren't reacting to any specific policies that he had already implemented because he hadn't had the chance to implement a single one. On the website of my organization, the National Security Archive, which is nsarchive.org, we have just now posted a series of documents on Kissinger's role in arguing for the overthrow of Allende. And one of the documents that we post is a comprehensive position paper that he presented to Richard Nixon in which he laid out the arguments about what the threat of Allende's election was for the United States. And in very candid prose, because he never thought that this document would ever be read by anybody else but Richard Nixon, he argued that the real problem for the United States was the legitimacy of Allende's election. He was democratically elected. What could the United States do? If he successfully governed, his would become a model for other countries to emulate, and the United States would have no power to oppose the democratic will of people in other countries, including, Kissinger told Nixon, countries like Italy in Europe. As he basically said, there would be the imitative spread of this phenomena. There would be the insidious example of Allende's model of being a democratically elected socialist. And this model could spread to countries in Europe, and that would start to change the world balance of power, as he put it, and our position in that balance of power. And so for that reason, he pressed Nixon to overrule the State Department, which wanted to basically come to kind of a modus vivendi with Allende, recognizing that it would be extremely counterproductive for the United States to be hostile to his democratic election. And if we intervened in Chile, we would just make a bad name for ourselves among the, you know, and arouse the left and nationalism throughout the rest of Latin America. So Kissinger single-handedly, you know, pressed Nixon to go ahead and tell the national security bureaucracy, we can't live with Allende. We have to do everything we can to bring him down. And that was the discussion they had, and that was the policy he pursued.
Okay. So what about looking at the way the coup itself was conceived? I mean, laying down the groundwork. Could tell us a little bit about the critical role that René Schneider and that whole faction of the military, how important it was for the U.S. to nullify that element. Can you explain that based on what's been uncovered?
Well, there's two phases of U.S. intervention in Chile after Allende's elected. Allende's elected on September 4th, 1970. He's not due to be inaugurated until 2 months later, on November 4th. And in between that time, in late October, he faces in Chile what's known as a ratification vote, because he hasn't been elected by the majority, actually. And Chile, it was not a two-party state. It was basically a three- or four-party state. And the election results were basically split three ways between oligarchical candidates, Jorge Alessandre, between middle-of-the-road centrist candidate, Vladimir Tomic, and Allende on the left. And Allende won between the three of them, and he needed to be ratified by Congress. So the initial covert operations set in motion by Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger were focused on keeping Allende from being ratified and then inaugurated. They considered the idea of bribing Chilean congressmen to vote against him. And then they came up with this plan that they would kidnap the Chilean commander-in-chief of the armed forces, General René Schneider, who opposed kind of a military move to supersede the democratic election in Chile. And they would pay a group of military officials to kidnap him. They would blame his kidnapping on Allende's forces somehow, and then the military would step in and annul the election, claiming that Allende was anti-democratic and violent and all of that. And, you know, the CIA shipped arms to Chile. They started paying this group of plotters, meeting with them. The operation against Schneider took place on October 20th, right before the ratification vote. Instead of kidnapping him, they shot and killed him. Mm. And in the aftermath of this, Chileans were outraged. It was as if somebody had come into Washington, D.C. and shot on the streets the chief of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Chileans were outraged, and of course they blamed the rightist forces, and Allende was immediately ratified as kind of a, probably with more votes than he would have gotten otherwise. And then the CIA paid the these assassins $35,000 in hush money so they wouldn't say anything about the U.S. role, and money to help them escape Chile so they would never have to talk about it. And that was the first phase. It was called Track 2. It failed. Again, it was inaugurated. And then you had a second phase of U.S. covert operations, the destabilization phase, in which Nixon called together his national security team and said, you know, we can't live with Allende. We're going to bring him down. We're going to quietly cut off economic credits. We're going to funnel money to the opposition newspaper, which will call for, you know, kind of upheaval and attack the government. We're going to send money to the Chilean military to try and buy influence there. And we're going to work to create a climate in which a coup can take place and succeed. And that is what happened. The famous word was destabilization, and it basically evolved over a period of 3 years. Allende was overthrown 40 years ago today on Chile's 9/11, if you will. And immediately the new military leaders were welcomed first secretly by Henry Kissinger and then openly. Mm.
Were there other corporate players that also contributed to setting the Nixon administration's focus on this subversion of the Chilean society?
Yes, very famously, Chile's economy at the time was more or less controlled by U.S. economic interests. Two huge mining conglomerates, Kennecott Copper and Anaconda Copper. And the famous IT&T Corporation, the International Telegraph and Telegram Corporation. And IT&T was one of these companies that just felt like it should run the world. And it should run the U.S. government as far as well as everybody else. And the chairman of IT&T started basically calling CIA officers into his office to say, you know, our interests are at stake here in Chile, and if Allende succeeds, then our interests in other countries in Latin America are at stake also. We want to start funneling money secretly to affect the election in 1970. We want to funnel money to the right-wing candidate. We want you to funnel that money with us. The CIA didn't need IT&T's money to intervene in the election. They did meet with IT&T no less than 40 times over the course of a year in 1970 and 71. And IT&T clearly had quite a bit of influence. The richest man in Chile, the media mogul, the Rupert Murdoch of Chile at the time, Augustine Edwards, he also had a great deal of influence. He came to Washington right after Allende was elected, met with CIA Director Richard Helms, lobbied for the CIA to move against Allende forcibly and foment a coup, as the CIA tried to do. But really, you know, the $1 billion of U.S. investment in Chile at the time was a factor, and it's listed in Kissinger's arguments to Nixon. But there was more to it than that. It was this idea that we were kind of that the world was a strategic chessboard in which the U.S. needed to control everything. And if some country, one little country, Chile, which Kissinger himself had disparaged just the year before as a dagger pointed at the heart of Antarctica, in other words, a country that was a threat to nothing but an iceberg, now suddenly he's telling Nixon that this is the most important foreign policy decision you're going to make. This could be the most important failure for your administration in foreign policy if we don't make sure that Allende fails and is overthrown. And because of this idea that other countries would eventually elect socialist-communist coalitions and we would have no influence over them. And even worse, they'd be elected in European countries like Italy and Greece and Spain and France, etc., and somehow the NATO alliance would be undermined. And of course, the irony is that Kissinger was right. There were other Euro-communism and other countries did like socialist leaders, but he was wrong in that it didn't affect the NATO alliance in any way, shape, or form. But you get, when you read these documents, which are now on our website and now available, you just see the imperial mind speak, the arrogance of top U.S. foreign policy makers taking it upon themselves to determine the fate of the future of another country.
Yeah, they were quite explicit about that, weren't they?
Very, very explicit.
So what kinds of lessons could be learned, or what lessons were learned by the government as a result of this whole exercise that would guide them in terms of prosecuting other coups across Latin America and the Middle East and other places?
Well, the United States had been intervening in the affairs of other countries for many, many years, particularly Latin American countries. The CIA had gone in and overthrown the government of Guatemala in 1954. They'd gone into Iran the year before, 1953, and engineered, the overthrow of the leftist-leaning government there, the nationalist government there, and installed the Shah, a history that still haunts us to this very day, by the way, in our relations with the Middle East. We were involved in the 64 coup in Brazil. We invaded the Dominican Republic in 1965. The list of U.S. intervention goes on and on. Chile, in some ways, was the beginning of the United States supporting these murderous military regimes throughout the Southern Cone in Latin America. Argentina had a coup a year later, and the United States, Kissinger avidly supported the bloodshed there against the left. Uruguay, the military took over. Bolivia, the military took over, et cetera. So in any event, what did we learn? Well, the problem for Nixon and Kissinger and others to come in the future was that Chile and Kissinger's embrace of Pinochet set in motion, unleashed the human rights movement as we know it in this day and age. And that movement pushed to have human rights be a formal criteria of U.S. foreign policy. It was something I call the Chile syndrome, which was the position of the American public to COVID intervention in our name against democratically elected governments was bad, and embraces of military regimes like that of Pinochet was not the values that we had. And so new laws were passed constraining the executive branch's powers on supporting the Pinochets of the world. And then, of course, when Pinochet was arrested, that started to hold torturers and murderers responsible for their crimes, accountable for those crimes. We have a situation where the former president of the United States, George Bush, could well someday, just like Pinochet, face international reckoning and international judicial process for the torture, renditions, assassinations, secret detention camps that he and his top national security advisors authorized in the post 9/11 world.
Yeah, so he's been, as you say, Pinochet. Is that the lexicon?
There's a new verb in the lexicon of the human rights movement to be Pinochet. Huh. And Kissinger faced this issue. He went to France, and suddenly a judge served him a subpoena to interrogate him about what he knew about certain crimes the Pinochet regime had committed. He was due to go to Brazil, Kissinger was, after Pinochet was arrested, and a judge there said, I'm going to want to question Henry Kissinger about Brazil's role, working with Chile, and what he knew about that. Bush himself has had an issue about going to Switzerland recently. So this is an issue. It reflects a change in the world mindset about how countries, deal with the issue of human rights. The same moral issues that Barack Obama is raising about the international community's need to respond to the use of chemical weapons in Syria is an issue in terms of human rights that the world has already raised now around Pinochet, and the international community looks at torture, international human rights crimes in a far different way than we did before Augusto Pinochet. necessary, and Henry Kissinger came along.
Now, Peter Cole Kornbluh, I guess one more point. This is the 40th anniversary, and you've released a 40th anniversary edition of the Pinochet file. Are there any new additions that that are worthy of mentioning that you'd like to let people know about?
The new book has several key new things in it. It updates what happened to Pinochet in Chile between 2003 and 2006 when he died. He was indicted a second time by Judge Juan Guzman for international terrorism crimes. He was revealed in Washington that he was not only murderous but corrupt. He had stashed more than $26 million away in more than 100 secret bank accounts that he opened with false passports and false names. That scandal shook the roots of his reputation in Chile among even his most diehard supporters. And he faced a bunch of corruption crimes and charges and indictments when he died on December 10th, 2006, ironically, International Human Rights Day. So that's in the book, the corruption scandal and the other indictments. And then to the book is added some new documents, including the transcript of Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger's first conversation on the telephone after the coup in Chile, in which Nixon and Kissinger discuss what they did there, how they helped the coup, how the CIA created the conditions as best as possible for the coup to succeed. And they complain about how the liberal media, as Nixon put it, the liberal crap in the media, is bemoaning the overthrow of Allende. And Kissinger assures the President of the United States that in the Eisenhower period, you know, at the height of the Cold War in the 50s, quote, we would be heroes, unquote. And that document we didn't have before, and now we do. And I think it's extraordinarily important 40 years later, as we are talking about the 40th anniversary of the coup today, and the 40th anniversary of this conversation will be coming up in a few days, for the world, the international community, students of this history, to be able to read how these two men saw their accomplishment as Augusto Pinochet was killing people on the streets of Chile.
Peter Kornbluh is the author of The Pinochet File, a declassified dossier on atrocity and accountability, just recently released a new edition for the 40th anniversary of the Chilean coup. Peter Kornbluh, thank you very much for making yourself available for this interview. We really appreciated those insights.
I'm so happy to be on your program, and good luck.
Okay.
With everything.
Thanks a lot.
Best wishes.
Yes, you too. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can hear our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across the country. We are broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.